The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm joined on the telephone by Christopher Golden out in Massachusetts. He's got a new book out. It's called The House of Last Resort. Welcome to the program, Christopher.
Thanks very much for having me.
You write horror, I'm gathering, from reading this book. It's like, whoa, this is intense.
Yeah, thank you. I've written all kinds of genres, but the lion's share of what I've done over the years definitely falls into the horror category. I would say the horror people are my people.
And you've been putting out books for what, 30 years?
30 years, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get the idea for? Excuse me?
I started young.
Uh-huh. How'd you get the idea for this?
pardon me. Over the past 4 or 5 years, so many times I've run across articles online about places, usually in Italy, but I know that they're doing it in Japan and Germany and a number of other places, where there are towns where so much of the population has moved into cities that the towns are sort of being abandoned. And particularly in Italy, the youth leave. And these beautiful old hill towns and other places become sort of ghost towns, and they're dying out. And so the solution that has been adopted by many of these places is that they sort of open up ownership of abandoned buildings and homes to people around the world for often just absolutely insane bargains in exchange for your residency. So basically there are places in Italy where you can buy a home for €1. Some of them that I've seen, you need to come and spend, you have to live there full time. You can't Airbnb it. You can't rent it out or just use it, but you have to live there and you have to spend a certain amount of money over the course of 5 years, to fix it up, to renovate. And if you don't do that, you sort of forfeit your ownership. But I just thought, what would happen if you did that and you sort of rebooted your life in a foreign land and discovered more than you bargained for?
And I'm guessing another factor in this in countries like Japan and Italy is they have a declining birth rate. They're not replacing the people that are dying, so these towns are just kind of shriveling.
Yes, exactly.
You have this couple, and they've moved from America, and they're arriving in this hill town. Is it Bacina?
I say Bacina, but it's,
Bacina?
It's an invented town. So,
okay. Tommy,
although it is based on a lot of places I visited.
Tommy and Kate Puglisi, you say you visited over there?
Yeah, my wife is 100% Sicilian. Her parents were both born and raised in Sicily, and her mom still owns a home there.
Oh,
I've been able to go over there a few times, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Hmm. I can imagine. So they arrive in this town where they've spent €1 for a house, and it was a weird situation where they had this one house that they were going to buy for €1, and then at the last minute, the realtor said, oh, wait, we've got this other house, and they saw this other house, and they're like, oh, that's the one we want. And it turns out to be the House of Last Resort.
Exactly. Which has, a mysterious history, as such houses often do, and it definitely has its share of haunting, but it has actually a lot more and darker secrets than that.
Another reason Tommy wanted to go there is because his last remaining family live in this village, and this is a big part of the story.
Yes. His parents are both gone, but his grandparents still live in this town in Sicily. So when it came up that this town was offering this kind of bargain, it just seemed like serendipity that it would be an opportunity for him to get to know his Sicilian family in a way that he had never had the time to do before. It's also, sort of interesting to me because, Tommy and Kate are a sort of young millennial couple who have no kids, and they both work remotely, as so many of us do now. So the opportunity is something they can seize. So not only are they there to, the town is trying to do this to sort of rebuild and restore and plan for a new kind of future, but they expect the people who are coming to the town to contribute to that, to bring their energy and their ideas and all of that. And Tommy and Kate are very eager to do that. It seems like an ideal setup until it isn't.
If you just tune in, my guest is Christopher Golden. We're talking about his new novel, The House of Last Resort. You're listening to Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, community-owned public radio for curious listeners. Tell us about this couple. Let's get into their personalities a little bit. They're very much in love, apparently.
They are. It's very interesting, and I'm not to throw anybody under the bus, but one of my first readers is an older person. Who, when he read it, he came back to me and he said, well, I don't really like the way that they interact, and she seems a little shrill, and I sort of laughed to myself, and I thought, well, because they treat each other as equals, and so the reaction from some readers who maybe grew up in a different era. Is going to be, boy, she says what she thinks, and she does. But to me, that's a very good thing. So yeah, they're a couple who are equals and who have, I think, a really healthy relationship. And that was one of the things that I wanted to do in this, is I wanted to write a horror novel in which the main characters are a happily married couple, which if you go back through the genre in general and many genres, that's not what you usually get.
They're usually having dysfunction. They're bad marriages.
Yeah. I mean, they'd be bad marriages, or they're a couple who don't communicate. And that undermines them. And I just thought to myself, well, I just want to do it one time, where they're in it together. I thought that was it was an interesting thing to explore, because so often in horror you need to isolate an individual, and I thought it was really it was fun for me anyway, I guess, to have these characters balance each other pretty nicely.
Was this also a change for you? In previous books, you've had more of the dysfunction going on.
Well, I think partly. It was that in the immediately previous book, which is called All Hallows, which is a 1980s set horror novel set on Halloween night. It's an ensemble featuring a lot of different characters, and the whole book is loaded with dysfunctional marriages. There are couples getting divorced and couples cheating on each other and all of this stuff. And I think maybe it was a reaction to that particular book, just to say, let's have a couple who are healthy and in love.
Sure. It's like having a crime novel where the cop has a good marriage. You just don't see it.
Exactly.
Now, your first readers, this one you mentioned who's a little older and said that he thought that Kate was a little shrill. Did you tone her down a little bit after that? I didn't think she was shrill at all.
Yeah, no, I didn't tone her down at all.
Okay.
I just felt like, this is what I want to see in a relationship. So no, I didn't react to that at all.
Okay.
I just chalked it up to his age.
Tell us about Tommy.
The interesting thing to me about the Tommy and Kate dynamic is that, as in so many relationships There are a couple of people who know each other better than they know themselves, you know? And that's definitely the case with Tommy. You know, he's somebody whose mother was narcissistic. He had a difficult relationship with both parents, but always wanted to sort of find a familial relationship, support, and instead of stress, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so for him, the idea of leaving behind his home country is not just one of adventure, but it's also one of relief, you know? I think everybody dreams of the idea of some kind of new beginning, you know, a fresh start someplace.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to actually make that leap, especially because we have so many connections to family or community or employment obligations. And so I think that Tommy is very fortunate in that in this relationship with Kate, he has somebody who's willing to say, not only say yes, but who's willing to, you know, get online and search around and find a way to help make it happen. So I think that he probably thought it was not a possibility until it was. And, you know, honestly, part of that is because I always wanted to do that when I was younger. And I love my family. I have a brother and sister who I adore. But our relationship is not one that wouldn't be able to adapt to being long distance and travel and all of that stuff. My wife, though, ironically, though her family is Sicilian, they're all here. And so the idea when we were younger of moving abroad was really appealing to me. But to her, the idea of leaving her family here was just impossible to conceive.
Mm.
So it is a little bit of projection for me to have Tommy and Kate go through this process.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, and we'll continue with our interview with Chris Golden right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest today is Christopher Golden. We're talking about his novel, The House of Last Resort. I'm being careful not to do spoilers, but we need to know something about the grandparents here. The grandfather in particular, he's having some troubles.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, as we're so many of us go through a process like this, his grandfather's suffering from dementia. He's a very elderly man. He's fading. So there is an opportunity for Tommy to sort of get to know him a little bit, but in particular to get to know his grandmother. And cousins that he barely knows or was barely even aware of their existence prior to the move. But they have been in this town for their whole lives. And again, the town is one of those interesting towns. It's sort of a picturesque hill town in Sicily where there are a lot of new people moving in, which is new for them. But the people who have been there all along, they pretty much all know what this house really is, or was anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that it has a history tied up in the Roman Catholic Church and a number of other things. And there are catacombs beneath the city, which Tommy and Kate see as a potential tourist attraction.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about the way daily life kind of goes on unchanged for decades at a time in places like Bikina. I think personally, I've always been drawn to those places where you can sort of get lost in time or step back in time anyway. I loved writing his grandparents, and I loved writing all the other people that were local there. And I encourage everybody to visit Sicily.
Mm. And when we get to the part where they're talking about meeting some of these other people who have moved there to buy these 1 euro houses. They're from all over the place. They call them the imports, and they have this little group. They get together, and they are really hoping to bring some tourists to town to get this community thriving again. They have the catacombs like they have in Palermo. They see that as an aspect of, that would draw tourists. And this group that gets together, they're an interesting group. I could tell you were having fun with that. And also the whole aspect of the tourism, because obviously this community is shriveling, but it's easy to go the other way and have too much tourism and ruin a community.
It is. It is. And, you know, it's really interesting to me to sort of speculate on what that would be. I did have one review. The reviews have been excellent. But I did have one review that commented on the idea of all of these, the imports, the people who are moving into this community, and the topic of gentrification and all of that. But in the case of, you know, towns like this, they, I'm sure, would not think of it as gentrification. They think of it as resurrection. I mean, they literally are, these towns are, as you keep saying, withering, and I think that's a great word. And without this infusion of fresh blood and fresh ideas, they will vanish eventually, these towns. They will be abandoned and become literal ghost towns. And so, you know, when we talk about gentrification, to me, that's people moving into an existing thriving community and forcing out the locals because they are upscaling and pricing people out of their traditional neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
This is a case where all of these places are empty, and so when you begin to merge newcomers with the people who are still there, you're going to have change. And what the mayor in the book, and I think that the people who are inviting people from all over the world to come to move into these towns are looking for, is that injection of new blood and new ideas. And so in this case, I think that the fact that Tommy and Kate are embracing this, what they feel as a sort of a responsibility to try to fulfill, you know, the role that they've been given as newcomers, I think is great. I mean, I think it's something that you would like somebody to do because they're trying to fulfill their obligations. But you are right to think that what is the end goal? Like, what is the result eventually if that keeps up?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much of the thing that drew you there is going to remain 20 years later if you have completely, like, redone these places? Are they just going to look like the high street in any other European country with the same shops and the same, you know, the same look and all of that? So it is, it's a really interesting topic.
My guest is Christopher Golden. His book is The House of Last Resort, Resurrection. Nice word choice, Christopher. This is there's a lot of religion in this story, and I don't think it's a spoiler to bring up the topic of exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
And back in 1996, I had a guest on the show who was a Catholic priest from Ireland, and he wrote a number of bestsellers. His name was Malachi Martin, and he was an exorcist. One of his bestsellers was called Hostage to the Devil, The Possession and Exorcism of Five Living Americans. And when he died, 3 years after I interviewed him, of a hemorrhage of the brain, there were some people who claimed he'd been pushed from a stool by a demonic force.
I mean, you know, I have to be honest with you and say that I don't believe in any of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well.
You know, I grew up in the Catholic Church. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. I'm intrigued by what I think of as the mythology of, you know, demons and possession and exorcism and all of that. I think it makes for great stories. And, you know, but I think that the, you know, there was a really terrible television movie in the 70s, and I can't even remember the name of it. It was like Death Ship or something like that, but it was a TV movie. And I've often quoted this, and there's a line, basically, like, you know, they find this sarcophagus at the bottom of the ocean, and they bring it up, and it's and inside it is like the body of the devil or the Antichrist or something. I don't really remember, but there's a little poem that is said by one of the characters who says his grandmother used to always say it or something like that, and it went, "There is a devil, of that there is no doubt, but is he trying to get in us or is he trying to get out?" And that has always stuck with me because, you know, I'm fascinated by the concept of evil, but I think that we are the devil. But in the fictional sense, I'm fascinated by the idea of an external evil, and also by, you know, the idea. I would love to sit down with an exorcist. I would love to sit down and have a conversation and look at records and all of that, because I've wished my whole life to have some, you know, like I'm like Fox Mulder, you know, I want to believe. But I have yet to have any experience that cannot be chalked up to nature, and as opposed to the supernatural. I'm fascinated by it, but I'm incredibly dubious.
So is Tommy. So he's a little bit like you. My guest is Christopher Golden. The book is The House of Last Resort. Another fun aspect of this story is earthquakes. That's a big part of the story. We won't get into that. And then there's the aspect that we get into in your very brief first chapter. Anyone who reads this first chapter is going to read it and go, huh? And then as as we get into the story, we're going to go, oh, because rats are really a big part of the story, and they're emblematic of something. What are they a metaphor for?
You know, I feel like it's more about our response, the sort of visceral, sort of atavistic response that we have to vermin. And so completely irrationally, I mean, so we have this response to rats because they once were, and I use the word responsible loosely, but they once were responsible for, you know, spreading the plague that killed, you know, a massive percentage of the human race. And so we have this response. It isn't like snakes. I think that we have the sort of primal response to snakes that we have because so many snakes are poisonous or venomous, I should say. And some of those can kill us. And so, you know, in the lizard brains of our shared ancestral memory, we know that we should be scared of snakes, or repulsed by them in some way. But I think that we feel that way about rats because of the plague. Because there is this memory of, oh, they are responsible. And so the idea of rats carrying some kind of contagion or some kind of plague or threat is just so deeply ingrained in us that I thought, well, you know, what if they do? And I don't want to go in too much beyond that, but that was really the thought process is, you know, what is in them that makes us respond this way to them.
Well, once we start encountering them in the story, we know that this is a trend line that's going to just keep rising. The book is The House of Last Resort by Christopher Golden, and you do mention a few bands in here. I think you mentioned U2 and a few others. And I thought I picked up a little musical homage near the end of the book, and maybe this was just in my mind, or maybe it was your intent But on page 279, you write, "Tommy, can you hear me?" And I immediately went, "Oh, the Who."
I have to say, it's funny. I didn't do it on purpose, but the minute I wrote it, I had the same reaction you did.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I like that. That woke me up.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I looked at your bibliography and the output of stuff. You're a very prolific guy, and you've done a lot of, like, comic books?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this, as you said, for 30 years. My first novel came out 30 years ago, this May, I think. And I've written a lot of comics. I've written screenplays, video games. I just co-wrote and co-directed last year the podcast Slayers of Buffyverse Story, which was a sort of 10 years later full cast with the original cast members sequel to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. All kinds of other stuff. You know, I'm just a storyteller by nature. And so I've worked in so many different mediums, because to me, it's all about telling stories.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you do a project with Joe Hill?
I think the only thing I wrote the introduction before I knew that he was Joe King.
Uh-huh.
I wrote the introduction to Joe's first short story collection, which was his first mainstream published book, 20th Century Ghosts.
Okay. Well, so you didn't even know he was Stephen King's kid, huh?
I did not.
Oh, wow.
I thought I was doing this this young guy a big favor.
Sure. Well, I had Joe Hill on the show years later, and I didn't mention his dad because I figured he didn't want to talk about him.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that it's taken time because, it was very important to him at the beginning of his career that he make it without being perceived as riding on his dad's coattails. And of course, we all know, anybody who's read Joe knows that he's extraordinarily talented in his own right. But at the time, he was keeping it very close to the vest.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea.
That's amazing. My guest has been Christopher Golden. His book is The House of Last Resort. And before I let you go, what are you working on? What do you got in the pipeline?
Well, I'm about two-thirds of the way through a new novel, actually probably more than that. And I'm continuing to write a variety of comic books, mostly for Dark Horse Comics, including Hellboy in Love and a number of other things. Always keep them busy.
Okay, I can tell. Well, this is really a page-turner. You had me up late at night finishing it. It's The House of Last Resort by Christopher Golden, who's been my guest on the program today. And I'll look forward to reading more of your stuff. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Don't touch that dial. We have a Book Nook bonus segment coming your way. On Monday, I lost another astronaut. One of the early astronauts who has been my guest on the program died, General Thomas Stafford. And we're going to remember him coming up in a segment from that interview right after this. The Book Nook continues with an extra segment this morning as we remember General Thomas Stafford, who died on Monday at the age of 93. He was one of our early astronauts. He flew four times in space and orbited within 9 miles of the moon's surface on the mission that preceded the moonwalks of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin in July of 1969. When General Stafford flew with the civilian astronauts Donald K. Slayton, known as Deke, and Vance D. Brand in the Apollo capsule that docked with the Soviet Union's two-man Soyuz, some 140 miles above the Earth, he looked beyond the rivalries of world powers. This is from his obituary in the New York Times. In 1959, when NASA chose the first group of seven astronauts for its Project Mercury in America's race to put a man on the moon, General Stafford, a lanky 6-foot Oklahoman who was then a junior Air Force officer, was on the selection list. He had been a test pilot and an instructor. He had graduated from a service academy and he had a scientific bent, but he was an inch too tall for the Mercury capsules. He enrolled at what became Harvard Business School in September 1962, but on his 32nd birthday, 3 days after his arrival in Cambridge, he was offered a spot in NASA's Gemini program, since he could fit into the larger capsules that would soon be launched. He put Harvard behind him. He flew twice for the Gemini program and became an expert in rendezvous, the link-up of two spacecraft that would be required for a moon voyage. And famously, he hooked up with a cosmonaut in outer space. And 6 years later, General Stafford's Apollo capsule caught up with a Soyuz launched by the Soviet Union, and the two spacecraft drew close to adjoining orbits. He radioed the Soviet astronauts and said in Russian, "We have capture." Colonel Leonov replied in English, "Well done, Tom. It was a good show." And we had a good show with Tom Stafford back in the day, talking about his memoir. It's called We Have Capture.
You have some funny stories in the book. You obviously have a good sense of humor. I love the one where the guy in Samoa got offended when you were coming back from space. That was a good one. And then also, you spent so much time in the Soviet Union, and it was sort of an assumed thing that they had bugs on everything and they could listen. And right. So whenever you didn't like something, you would just sit in your hotel room and you would complain about the beer or the flies, and they would immediately take care of the problem.
That's right. It was as good as room service, and we call it "Govorichi Nastanya," speak to the walls. It worked. I don't know if it'll work now, but it worked in those days. They spent a lot of time and effort on monitoring everybody, but you know that was just part of their modus operandi, part of their society, and. So we just use it to our advantage.
And you really got involved in some kind of almost cloak and dagger stuff when Soyuz 15 went up. They gave you a pretty tough job.
Well, that's true. They said Soyuz 15 went up, and they said it just there had already been a little space station salute that had been manned, and here they went up and And they tried to dock with it, and the thing malfunctioned, obviously. But I didn't know what it was at the time. But George Lowe, the deputy administrator of NASA, said, "Look, Tom, you just don't fly up to a space station that's already been manned. You just go up and just fly around it and come back." Well, he says, if they tried to dock, and if they had some failures, and yet they come back and said everything is fine, said sooner or later that, said the word's going to leak out, and then he says Apollo Soyuz is going to be dead because they know that the Soviets lied to us. So said you got to find out, and so I wrote up the episode in the book what happened that time and how I finally got it out of him.
I thought that was very impressive.
Well, thank you, sir.
Obviously, there's a great deal of luck involved in being a successful astronaut. It's dangerous. Some of your colleagues have been killed. In this sort of line of work, and you describe an experience when you were first learning how to fly, when you were trying to fly with instruments, where another plane just barely missed you.
Oh, it hit us. Our propeller cut off part of his wing, and his part of it collided with our right wing. Had he been about 3 feet lower, nobody probably ever heard of him.
And when we had Gene Cernan on the program, he also described in his book that flight to St. Louis where the plane that you were with crashed.
Right. I was flying front seat, flying the wing, and I broke off, and they tried to keep circling around in the field, and I could see the weather was deteriorating. Said, I had a lot of weather flying experience, so I just said missed approach and picked up the gear and went out.
And then you had that oxygen supply thing with that Apollo flight that, by the grace of God, you didn't have that happen to you.
Right, right. You know, when we breathed in the rocket fuel there after landing, it flipped upside down. Apollo Soyuz, right.
So there's a lot of luck involved.
Yes, sir.
What does a ram's eyeball taste like, by the way?
Well, after you had a few vodkas, it's... It wasn't as bad as if you'd done it without any vodkas.
My guest is General Thomas P. Stafford. His book is We Have Capture, Tom Stafford and the Space Race. How did it feel when you were floating in space and you saw your Soviet counterpart, your friend, coming toward you. What was it like?
Well, it was great because we'd worked over 2 years very hard on the program. And so that was a combination of 2 years of hard work. So it was real good. Of course, you know, the main thing that really made me happy is I manually flew the spacecraft in with the docking module in the front of it and docked right on the money there with the Soyuz and everything. But then we finally opened the tunnel and everything, and there he was after we'd trained and worked together for over 2 years.
Were you scared?
No. I knew things would go good. The spacecraft were locked up tight together, and we're in great shape.
It takes a certain kind of guy to do that.
Oh, thank you.
And then you had it all set up where you had a recording of some girls and some water.
Now,
this is a very funny story.
Well, what there's always jokes, you know, like, you know, we'd be practicing the simulator, the mock-up, and we'd get together, and we'd usually run ahead of time because I always like to be ahead of schedule. And often I'd be, you know, Alexi would be on the other side of this mock-up, and the Soyuz mock-up would be in the docking module, and I'd knock, and he'd knock back. So we got up in space, we're running ahead of time, so I knocked, and I heard his knock come back, and I said, Katobu to Tom. Like, who's there? Like, who else could be there 140 miles up? And then, but also I said, if everything went right, advanced happened, bring this little tape, you know, little tape cassette on board. And we had a tape recorder, and he says, everything goes right, and we're finished, and undocking, everything's fine. Says, we're going to play this joke on him. And so before we had, you know, the synchronous satellites up there for continuing track like we have now, no tracking ships out there. We're drifting apart after our 2 days together, and they're about 30 miles apart. And so I had the thing all set up, so I told him, I spoke to him in Russian with an Oklahoma accent. I said, Alexei, what are you doing now? I says, Kakti Deli, Stichos. He says, oh, Tom, says, we're rusty. We worked hard. I told him in Russian, well, unfortunately, we have to keep working. He said, we're still working. He says, why? I said, Slishisha. I said, listen. And with that, Vance turned on a tape recorder, a decal down the mic button. Suddenly, hear this rushing of water like a shower, and all these girls are giggling in the shower and laughing and giggling. And just for a second, Alexi says, Tom, what are you doing over there? Then he says, you're joking, aren't you?
Oh, my. It's amazing when we look back at the days of the space program and all the things that were going on, to look at the situation now. And in your book, you reflect on the impact of politics and on different presidential administrations. We have the days of Vice President Agnew being quite involved with NASA.
Right, right. He headed the Space Council.
We also have the situation. You have some comments upon Carter and Clinton and what they meant to the space world. And
right.
I'm wondering now that we have a Republican Congress and a Republican president, whether you have any thoughts on where we're headed next.
Well, NASA has done a great job, I think, restructuring itself. And they've got some good, solid managers in there now, headquarters, and they've changed, you know, some of the managers around or other places. The main thing is is a commitment out of administration. President Bush's father was a great positive influence on the space program. He had a budget going up. He's once said that we should return to the moon after the turn of the century and then eventually go on at least for an expedition to Mars. But then when he was defeated by Mr. Clinton in 92, went out and Clinton immediately scrapped many of the technology plans he had. And the NASA budget went, instead of going up, it went way down. But now, the George W. Bush president, he hasn't made any real push. He's put in, and, you know, naturally his own administrator of NASA and some people there. But I don't think that you will see a major push until after the next presidential election, if he does it. But it takes a push from a president. If you look back, to go to the moon, that was Kennedy. That was President Kennedy. To build a space shuttle, that was personally, even though a lot of people said don't do it, was Richard Nixon's.
Uh-huh.
And then the space station, even though a lot of people said don't do it, was Ronald Reagan's. So it takes a commitment from the president.
And it's down the road because it doesn't happen overnight.
That is correct.
You were in Moscow in 1972, right when the Watergate thing was coming down, and you actually...
74, yeah.
Was it 74? You were talking to President Nixon
right.
in Moscow, and that was a little odd.
It was. It was only about 3 weeks before he resigned, and I'd just gotten there about a couple of days before, and he'd been on his whirlwind tour around the Europe for about 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, and making a great diplomatic tour, and he was just tremendously excited and enthused and, about what all he'd accomplished, and obviously he had accomplished a lot, but in the meanwhile, all heck was breaking loose back here in the States.
Mm-hmm. And he said something kind of odd to you.
Well, he said, he says, Tom, we've accomplished so much here. We're down at the far end of the Great Hall of St. George back during, they came down, Brezhnev and Nixon, to meet the Apollo Soyuz, mm-hmm. astronauts, cosmonauts. And they just happened, and the whole hall was lined with admirals, generals, the Apollo Bureau, the whole thing, and we were at the end. And they walked all the way down. Kissinger was there, Dobrynin, Gromyko. So he got me, so I said, just think how many things we've done here, says. Remember, he says, Tom, when you talk about 12,000 nuclear weapons, just how many villages in India do you want to destroy?
Uh-huh.
And he says, I wasn't about to get in that geopolitical way. I said, well, Mr. President, that's a very difficult question. I don't. So, but yeah. Obviously he was just very enthusiastic, excited about what he had accomplished there, meeting with the Secretary of the Party, Mr. Brezhnev.
I think he didn't want to think about domestic problems at that point.
Well, that was probably true, because he'd been on a whirlwind tour, and obviously accomplished a lot there diplomatically and internationally. But in the meanwhile, all heck was breaking loose back here in the country.
The crash of the space shuttle seemed to have a very negative impact on the space program. What would you have done differently to maybe prevent that?
Well, if a problem, technical problem surfaces, you've got to bring it all the way to the top. And, we'd had some problems, it turns out, on 17 of the previous 24 on those seals.
Mm-hmm.
That, started, it was sooty had gone, there'd been some sooty residue through there, maybe a semi-burn through, and it was identified as, quote, a problem. But it was kind of a go-go type of situation, and a lot of people said no go that morning when there was ice there.
Mm-hmm.
But people said, no, go ahead. So, I think, number one, you had addressed the problem long ago.
Yeah.
And, in Apollo, I'll tell you, that's what, in the tragic fire, a few of us, really complained about that inward sealing hatch. And he says, no, we can't change to an outward open hatch. It's too heavy. Its schedule won't allow it, all that. And everything came to a halt.
My guest is General Thomas P. Stafford. His book is We Have Captured, Tom Stafford and the Space Race. The book has just been published by the Smithsonian Institution Press. I see you got a plug from Senator John Glenn on your book. And,
right. John was kind enough to write into it. John's a real good friend of mine, and we've known each other for years, and all the way from the second group of astronauts. He was in the first group, and then I would see him, when he'd be in the Senate. And then my last job, I was the Air Force Deputy Chief of Staff for Research, Development, and Acquisition. A lot of key programs started, and he was on the Senate Armed Services staff. So, I worked with him real close.
Well, he's really amazing because he's so down to earth.
He is. He's a wonderful person.
And for an astronaut, that's pretty impressive.
Right.
When we see films, those of us that have never been in space, which is like almost everybody, you guys are a very special breed. When we see films like The Right Stuff, we wonder, how accurate are these depictions of what really happened? Have you seen that film?
I saw the film. I think the part on Chuck Yeager may have been a little overblown about, his part, but it was cute the way they did it.
Uh-huh.
And some of the parts were very accurate.
You guys like to drive fast cars, don't you?
Well, some of them did. I think it was Gus and Gordo in the first group, and Pete Conrad in my group, and let's see, who else? I think that was the main one. Al Shepard, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. I think even Buzz Aldrin liked to race around a little bit. Didn't he have a Corvette?
He may have.
Yeah. When Gus Grissom sank the capsule, what happened?
He said he was sitting there. Again, I wasn't on the program then.
Uh-huh.
He was sitting there, and suddenly the hatch blew out, and the waves came in, and There was always a controversy. Did the hatch just suddenly explode by itself, or did he accidentally bump in the actuator onto it? Or, you know, nobody will ever know. You know, they, amazingly, they recovered it out of about nearly 15,000 feet of water. And it's on display now. Several of you traveling around the country on the Smithsonian owns it, you know.
You had a rather harrowing experience with Gene with all that insulation that got loose.
Right. That's the insulation on the forward hatch seal blew out when we pressurized the tunnel, the lunar module down in there. And then when he went down, said he came out looking like a hound dog had been in a chicken house. His eyebrows, his hair was covered with white stuff.
Well, this is really a wonderful book and a wonderful part of the historical archive, and we're so pleased that you've had time to talk to us about it and that you took the time to write it.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be back here in Ohio with all the great history, and this is where, you know, people started to fly above the surface of the earth and powered flight for the first time. And so everything has always said space always came from aviation. Without the background we'd had in aircraft and jet aircraft, we could have never gone into space, because it was the systems we had developed, electric, pneumatic, hydraulic, you know, the aerodynamics, and all the boosters and the spacecraft were all built by aircraft builders.
Hmm. Do you have any words of advice to a young person that might want to go into this line of work?
Well, I'd say always look to the future, study hard, and try to do your best.
And keep an eye on the sky.
Yes, sir.
Well, General Stafford, I know you've got a busy schedule ahead of you, so we really appreciate your time today, and thanks for all your words.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to talk to the show here today and talk to your audience there, and I'd certainly heard of your station, and so it's I've been back here several times. I've been in the National Aviation Hall of Fame, and of course I had visited Wright-Patterson so many times in the Air Force there. So well, you do a great job at WISO there, NPR.
Thank you so much, General Stafford, and I know you're a friend of Neil Armstrong, who lives in our listening area, and if he's ever available for an interview, you just tell him we'd love to have him.
All right. Well, Neil's a wonderful person, and his hometown was Wapakoneta. And we used to, you and I came a couple of times when we were developing the flight control system for a lunar module. I had a simulator up at the old North American Aviation plant in Columbus.
Uh-huh.
And so a couple of times I went over and spent the night at his house. There we did that several times.
Thank you so much for your time, General.
Thank you, and certainly appreciate being here in Ohio, and thank you for the interview.
And that was General Thomas Stafford, who died on Monday at the age of 93, and he nearly met disaster in outer space. After 9 days in space, according to the New York Times, the Apollo spacecraft, which had been launched from Cape Canaveral to Florida, splashed down 330 miles northwest of Hawaii, almost precisely on target. But the astronauts' mishandling of switches during descent allowed a noxious gas to enter their chamber, affecting the lungs of all three crewmen and resulting in their brief hospitalization upon landing. Mr. Brand said he was to blame for the mishap, but General Stafford said the crew bore a collective responsibility. Back in the day, I interviewed four of our early astronauts on this program. Five interviews. I did two with Buzz Aldrin, second man on the moon. I did one with the late John Glenn, a legend. And I did one with Eugene Cernan, who also died a few years ago. And now we've lost Tom Stafford, who visited the program once when he was in Dayton to visit the Air Force Museum. And what a life. A man from Oklahoma who made it into the early space program with his memoir, We Have Capture. So Buzz Aldrin is the last one standing out of that group of astronauts who have appeared in the Book Nook. And I'm happy to be able to dig into the archive and be able to pull out their voices from the past. And we had fun on the program. He laughed at my joke, and I hope you enjoyed that. And you can go into our podcasts at wyso.org and listen to the interviews that we had with those other astronauts. We have over 1,000 podcasts there. Thanks for listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. For the Book Nook, my name's Vic McCunis.